It's Saturday morning, and it's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And yes, it's true. America's prodigal son has returned and is sitting in the studio with me.
Or solicitation.
Hand rested and probably fleeced pretty well.
Yeah, yeah, all of that. It was a great trip. We really had a good time, and we learned a lot about a lot of things. And one of them is...
Yeah, give us a little detail on
it.
I think everybody's interested, and I think what you're doing, let's predicate this with happy birthday, Justin, who will be 16 on Sunday.
Yeah.
And will be a driver on Monday.
Yeah, so you may, on Monday, just watch out on the roads.
Exactly.
He is a new driver, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, but kids are at the perfect age, and they have been educated enough to know a lot of things about the country, and they just got exposed to quite a few of them, I would think.
Yeah, and it was really really interesting. From an economic perspective, I can tell you there is no recession on the East Coast of the United States. We stopped in four places, and not one of them appeared to have any recessionary signs anywhere. Everything was busy. There were people at restaurants. There were people at the grocery store. The roads were moderately busy, even during the non-peak hours, and it was just packed. And New York was full of tourists from other countries, and we heard 100 different languages if we heard one being spoken. And I just it's just so hard to figure out why there's such a disconnect between the between people outspending money and people saying that they are on the brink of economic collapse.
Yeah, well, it adds to our, 2.5-year quest to try to figure out this economy and be able to describe it. I've got more on that today. It's not getting a bit easier.
No, it's, I remember I was in an industry that was affected particularly hard by the 2008 Great Recession. And at that point, people were not only saying that the economy was bad, but they were not out spending money. I was traveling for work a ton back then, and I remember going to restaurant after restaurant for lunch while I was on the road, and there would be 2-3 other people in the entire restaurant.
I remember you talking about that.
It was really eerie. There was no one around. Now it's the total opposite. It's really crazy.
And expensive.
Well, yeah, and everything cost twice as much as it did back then. People were actually cutting prices back then. Yeah. Now they're not.
And how was New York booming?
It was busy, just people everywhere as usual. It was great. We had an excellent time. We had a hotel room that was slightly larger than the studio that we're in now. And after 4 days, we were ready to get the heck out of there. So
I can imagine that.
Made me very happy to live in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
But it was great. We had a really good time.
You hear so many mixed reviews.
New York. One thing I did take away from this was DC was immaculate. There was, I did not feel unsafe. There were some homeless people, but no more than you would see in downtown Jack's Beach. It really was not overrun. It was very, very clean. We rode the metro. It was one of the best metro experiences I've had, just very clean and felt safe. Mm-hmm. We went to New York. It was dirtier. New York's always dirty. I mean, there's not a time when you don't find the streets a bit dirty. But we felt very safe. We rode the subway everywhere, and not once did we have a negative incident. We did see some weird people, no doubt about it. There was one gentleman with a pigeon on his shoulder, that seemed to be trained. So it was very entertaining, but did not
practicing to be a statue.
Maybe, I don't know. But it was good. I really did not feel I felt like maybe if you went to in any city, if you go to downtown Jacksonville at night, you're not going to feel safe.
Right.
And I feel like there are definitely parts of New York where that will be true. But in the tourist areas, there are cops on every corner near Times Square. It was a very positive experience.
Good. And the Outer Banks?
Awesome place. Just really beautiful, natural beauty, as opposed to the overwhelming man-made size and scale of New York and DC. Great place. I would definitely go back again.
And how was the train ride? Something I'm always interested in.
Yeah, we went on Amtrak from D.C. to New York, mm-hmm. and it was
the full. Biden Express.
It was the train was full, as were all of our one flight home was also full, mm-hmm. as usual. But the Amtrak experience was really good. They left exactly on time, arrived right on time. It was excellent.
And yet you go some places and people are suffering.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that whole corridor is significantly overpaid relative to the rest of the world. And so many people working for the government and the pensions and the contractors and all that. People are very prosperous. They spend money today, tomorrow, and the next day around there. Not like that everywhere, but I'm glad to know that the wheels of progress are still churning up that way.
Yeah, it was funny because we did go to Union Station in D.C., and one of the people who works there was telling us, man, it's just not like it used to be. There used to be so many restaurants. Well, there was probably 10 operating restaurants in Union Station. Really? I guess there used to be 30, but you couldn't tell that. I mean, they were saying that it's nothing like it's a shell of its former self. But you honestly, if you didn't know better, there's no way you could tell.
And prices all over the place, significantly
all over the board. We went to some very nice dinners that were expensive, but we also ate the same price as Jacksonville. I won't call it cheap because nothing's cheap anymore. No. But we definitely had meals that were very normally priced, even in New York and D.C.
Okay. All in all, nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Little recovery now can't hurt anything.
Yeah, I mean, everything was still expensive, so yes, we need to recover financially and a little bit of sleep wise, but just a great trip. Highly recommended if you get the chance. Just so much to see and do. I felt like we did maybe a tenth of everything we could have done for both time and economic reasons.
You could stay in D.C. for pretty much as long as you wanted to, and just
really could
do various portions of the Smithsonian and the art gallery.
And it's free. I mean, it's a
great, well, prepaid.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But free to you at the time.
Right.
That's the really cool thing about DC is that there wasn't a lot of additional cost to go do some really cool stuff that we did. Like the Natural History Museum was amazing and completely free to us. It was cool.
Well, that's nice. I am very happy. You know, when you're sitting back home watching TV and looking at negativity everywhere, it's pretty easy to wonder what's going on with your family that's traveling around.
The thing I always take away from these things is that there's over 300 million Americans,
yep.
and it's just such a huge country. And if you want to sit back and pick out negative news all day, it's very easy to do. There's always something bad happening, but the thing is, we met so many friendly people, even in places that you don't consider naturally friendly.
Like D.C. and New York?
Exactly. And everyone was great. We had almost no negative experiences with people we interacted with. And that was my big takeaway from the trip.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, welcome home.
Thank you.
And now that we've pretty much exhausted the segment about the market, we'll move that over to right after the break. And just a little quick summary. We're still setting records.
Yeah.
Good lots week. And lots of them
good
this
week.
Yeah, it's, you know, I can't explain any of it, but we can sure summarize it for you and try to see where it's going right after the break. So don't go anywhere. We'll pay a few bills and be right back, and we'll dive into it. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we do have a trivia question, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales from First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. Everybody knows, if you follow the market at all this year, that it's really being driven by what we are calling today the Big Seven stocks. You know, NVIDIA is probably the one that's getting the most attention, but you know, just look around and see how Microsoft and Amazon and Apple are doing. Things are pretty good out there for the big guys. So here's the question. The S&P 500 index is up 16.7% year to date. Without those seven, what would be the change year to date on the S&P 500? And I'm not going to tell you if it's up or down. We'll make it a whole number. You got to guess the direction. And with that said, this week was, I guess my word for it was, kind of having fun.
Yeah, it was a really good week. And we lost 1.5 trading days to the holiday. Mm-hmm. And it was still a really good week. The Dow rallied 0.7%. That was on the low end. The S&P gained 2%, and the NASDAQ was up 3.5%. What a crazy week for the NASDAQ.
Isn't it?
Most of your portfolios, though, are probably, they're probably at an all-time high right now, but they're also probably lagging the returns in the market. And if you're not up 16.7% this year, which is what the S&P is up, don't worry.
No.
You're probably not alone. Unless you're only invested in the S&P, you're probably lagging because just about everything else is lagging the returns of the S&P this year, except for the NASDAQ. That's about the only thing.
If you're all in the S&P 500 and you have more than 100 grand or so, we got to talk.
Yeah, you may want to rethink that strategy.
Yeah.
So first of all, the breadth of the market is terrible right now, which is kind of what the trivia question relates to. There's only two sectors that are outperforming the market this year, and those are technology and communications services. Financials, up until recently, had also been outperforming, but it has broken down recently and is not any longer. Mid-cap stocks are up just over 6% this year, and small caps are actually negative by almost 1%. Dow stocks are also struggling. The Dow is up 4.7% this year compared to that 16.7% return on the S&P. The S&P value index is up just 5.6% this year versus the growth index, which is up 23.5%. So you can see where all the money's going.
Yep.
The small cap value index is down almost 5% this year. There's an area of real weakness. The S&P 500 equal weight index is up just under 5% this year. So that gives you an idea of where everything is. Outside of large cap growth, just about every way you look at the market is underperforming the actual market this year. When you add that to a bond market that's down 0.7% this year, you're most likely going to be underperforming the market. For just as a little exercise, I did a 60-40 portfolio of SPY and AGG. That would be up 9.7% year to date. So,
which is darn good.
But it's also 7 points below what the S&P is. So, don't get too concerned if you're not seeing that, if you're not matching the returns of the S&P. Another area, international markets, very mixed this year. So if you have international exposure, there's another reason you might be not matching the S&P 500 return. Most countries are showing muted growth, but a handful of countries are showing big, big losses. Brazil is down over 19% so far this year. Mexico is down almost 16%, with all of that drop coming in the second quarter after their elections. Hong Kong is down almost 10% this year. China's actually seen a modest gain of almost 4%, and that comes despite a 3% drop in June. India has been the best performing market that I could find, with a gain of over 14%. And June was a really strong month for India. It was up over 5%. The All World Index is up just 6.2% this year, so underperforming the S&P by 10%. And the Emerging Markets Index is up 6.7%, slightly outperforming the All World Index. The Commodities Index is also up this year, but just 5.4%. Some individual commodities are doing much better than that, though. Silver is up 22%, gold up over 12, oil is up almost 20, and agricultural commodities are up almost 15. The biggest loser is going to come as a surprise to no one who listens to the show regularly. It's been natural gas, which is down 14%.
Is this a recording?
Yeah. So with all that being said, let's talk some jobs. The ADP report that came out Wednesday showed an addition of 150,000 jobs, which was actually on par with the headline number of the government report, which came out on Friday, of 206,000. That headline number actually beat estimates of 190,000, so everything's great, right?
Maybe not.
Not so much. Kind of like the S&P right now, under the surface, everything was not fine.
Right.
The net revisions to the last 2 months were a negative 111,000, which actually makes this a pretty weak report. That was also the first time in 30 months that the unemployment rate rose above 4%. That was the third longest streak in history that just got broken. It's now at 4.1%. And one interesting trend that I spotted this week from online job company Indeed, which they're just one of those databases of open jobs. The number of job postings is down pretty much everywhere nationwide, but job postings are falling much faster in high tax states than they are in low tax states. I wonder why that is.
I can't say.
I know you have some more to add to the jobs numbers. We've been going back and forth with that a little bit this morning.
I do. Let's see what the effect of government is in the overall employment picture. So if you start out with your 206,000 and take away the 111, you're down around 105. And then 70,000 of those were government. So we're down in the 30 range when you take out government, direct government. Then there's what we call the indirect government jobs. Those are things like healthcare, which is really highly subsidized in its day-to-day operations by the U.S. government with Medicare, Medicaid, and so on and so forth. So you're actually quite a bit underwater in job growth, according to all the government statistics, if you take out the government jobs. Now, the point, I guess, could be taken either way or made either way, that, well, you can't just take them out because they're there. Governments are growing, and that goes at all levels. Governments are growing. Whether you think they should or not is kind of irrelevant to the statistics.
Depends what jobs they're filling, I think. Yeah. If it's teachers, okay. If it's exactly. Department of Energy employees, then probably not.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at the job openings, they kind of unexpectedly went up, but it was pretty much the effects of governments putting out feelers for hiring people. So the private economy right now is, I think, much closer to stagnant than people realize.
I think that's probably true. It's stagnant at a level, though, that's what's hard to figure out. Is if anecdotally, it seems stagnant at a fairly strong level. Yep. But also anecdotally talking to people on the street, it would seem stagnant at a fairly bad level. So where is it actually?
That's a
tough question.
Yeah, if you'd like to measure retail sales the way they do it, which is to not include the effects of inflation, people are spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
But if you go down beneath that and convert everything to real dollars instead of marginal dollars or nominal dollars, you are looking at a situation where there is probably a lower number of things being bought today than there was 6 months ago or a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Than a year ago, I would say for sure. Yeah.
And how that's going to shake out, I don't know, because we're really not having any luck doing the anti-inflationary things that people have to do if they want to get rid of this. So we're sitting here with a very stubborn inflation rate, and they're trying to sell us on the fact that inflation is coming down, so things should be cheaper. Well, that's not what inflation means. Inflation rate is coming down. Everything's more expensive day to day than it was the day before, just by less amount. So anybody who's feeling strapped in their job is not doing any better because the inflation rate is down. And I've been talking about this and writing about it quite a bit lately. Keeping up with inflation is actually a lot harder than you think it is. And the reason for that is taxes. I've been hearing various numbers around $1,100, $1,200 a month more that people are paying now than they were 4 years ago to buy the exact same things.
Yeah, I've heard those numbers.
So let's say you're paying $1,200 a month more and you get a raise for $1,200 a month. Well, then you're breaking even, right? Not so much. First thing that comes out of that $1,200 a month is your FICA withholding and your Medicare withholding, and that goes to 6.15 for the Social Security part alone, and that ends after a while, but the other one does not. But let's say you're off about a little over 7% because of the tax deductions mandatory. Now, most people also have to pay some federal tax if you're making any significant money, And that federal tax, it might be as low as 10 or 12%. It might be as high as 30 or 40%. Who knows? But the point is, by the time your paycheck turns into spending money, you might have, just kind of round it off, 80, 85% of that, which means you're still 15% short. Now, if you're going to catch up with that, you got to get another 15% raise, and you're going to lose 20% of that 15%. In other words, the wage price spiral is ongoing,
and
you can't catch up.
There's another factor. You have to save more for retirement to cover that additional $1,200 a month. So that's an added pressure that you're under as well.
Yeah, it's kind of a subtle way of making sure we don't live as well. And I'm going to add a little to that, but we have to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And the trivia question is still out there. First off, the lines are open, 904-222-8255. Trivia question. The S&P 500 index is up a bit better than 16% this year. And a lot of it is based on the performance of the so-called Big Seven stocks. Stripped out of the Big Seven, or the Big Seven stripped out of the other 393, what is the return on the S&P 500 year-to-date without the seven? Whole number, could be positive, could be negative. Don't know. All right. I can't remember where we were leading into this exactly, but we got talking a little bit about the inflation and how to get out of it and all that thing. And one of the things I've been looking at in the last week is the proposals that are in front of the Congress right now to, quote, fix Social Security. All of us, basically everybody that can breathe air, understands that Social Security is in a lot of trouble right now. The various dates don't vary too much. The due dates for when the so-called trust fund is going to be used up, and at that point, benefit cuts will be mandatory for everyone, present and future recipients. Now, that is only now at the real extreme, 10 years away. Now, back in the early 80s, everybody knew that we had a problem. And when Reagan came in, he addressed it. And he actually got changes made. But they were made in such a manner that it would only affect people who were decades from retiring. And by the way, I was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was told back in 83 that I was going to have to go longer than 65. But, hell, I was in my 30s, so
I
just figured on it.
I was also one of them. Of course, I wasn't paying attention back then, but because I was, I don't know, seven.
The moral of that story is very simple. If you get things done far enough in advance, you can do it relatively painlessly. Well, let's look at the dilemma Congress has now with Social Security. No one really addresses Congress with a real positive attitude, I don't think. What's their approval rating now, 17 or something like that?
I think it might be, it's neck and neck with Kamala Harris's.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah.
For one of those or both of those. Whatever. Anyway, I do grant them one thing. They are on the horns of a dilemma. They have been for a long time, and where they're at fault is they haven't addressed it. That dilemma is nobody will let you talk about cutting their benefits. You will be unelected from whatever position you're in less time than it takes to tell about it if you so much as bring it up. On the other hand, if you don't bring it up, you're going to be held responsible for tipping that date and 2032 or 3 or whenever it's coming, and everybody is going to get a 25% reduction or so, and that, of course, is untenable, and they would be fired then. So when we look back at this years from now and we say, well, they had all those years that this was known and they didn't do anything, well, you're right. We did, they did, and they didn't. They did nothing. So right now, a lot of people are addressing this issue as only Congress can. So I looked up a few of the proposals that are in front of the Congress right now for fixing Social Security. One of them is called the Fiscal Commission Act of 2023, and this was introduced by a Republican from Michigan, and he would establish a fiscal commission to address the debt and suggest changes. Now, I don't know what you all think when you hear the term commission in D.C., but it's, to me, it's a bunch of guys sitting there washing their hands of the whole problem and giving them to some people who they're going to overpay to come up with solutions that won't be implemented anyway. So commission to me is just, it's worse than the negative. It's how things are gotten rid of. All right, another one called You Earned It, You Keep It. This was introduced by a pair of Democrats, one from Minnesota and one from Colorado, and it would repeal federal taxes on Social Security benefits. Well, I love that concept, partly because that's what the promise Social Security made to us when it got started, that it would never be taxed. But let's look at it with a more sincere eye right now. If you're trying to preserve, protect, and add longevity to a system, wouldn't the last thing you'd want to do would be cut the money that goes into the system? Because right now, taxes on Social Security benefits are directly credited back to the Social Security system. If that goes to zero, that due date in 2034 or 23 or whatever might come down to 2028. Well, yeah, it's a lovely idea, people, but get serious.
Yeah, now I don't understand what those people are thinking. The only time in history that Democrats are proposing tax cuts is at the worst time possible?
Yep, in the worst way possible. All right, let's go to number three, House Budget Committee Fiscal 2025 Budget. This was introduced by a Texas Republican, and guess what he wants to do? He wants to establish a fiscal commission to study cuts to benefits. That's enough said.
No, that you...
Really?
Oh, geez. Yeah.
Number four, Boosting Benefits and COLAs for Seniors Act. This was introduced by a Pennsylvania Democrat, and this Democrat wants the cost of living index, from which the annual increases in Social Security are computed, wants to change to the CPI for Americans ages 62 and up, which is lower than the CPI for regular Americans, and it's even worse than what Congress made us switch to a few years ago, the so-called chained CPI. The chained CPI takes into account the fact that when people can no longer afford something, they change their ways and means, their purchasing habits, whatever. So if steak is too pricey, you'll put in hamburger. So all they're going to reimburse you for is the hamburger, not the steak. Now, we're going to take it again to Americans age 62 and over because there are fewer things in there that they buy. For instance, housing, new housing and replacement housing is a lot less for those people who are not really moving around much anymore. All it does is say, okay, older people, you're going to get lower COLAs than you do now, and that's how we're going to fix the system. Well, I object. Yeah, well, not just as a recipient of Social Security, as an American, I object to Congress doing things that demand reducing the lifestyle of older people who have paid into it all their lives and it was not taken care of by the people who were charged to take care of it. So, to that one. Oh, one more. Social Security Overpayment of Fairness Act, which was introduced by two Democrats. It would grant recipients more time to come up with the money when they're notified they were overpaid, 6 months instead of 2 months. In other words, they're slowing down the cash flow back into the system because they overpaid it. And this is somehow supposed to be good for Social Security. Besides, if you give somebody 2 months to pay something back, and that something you want back is what you've given them, isn't it a lot more likely that it would be gone in 6 months than it would be in two? I think it would. This is going nowhere, obviously. This Safeguarding Social Security, this is the last one. Safeguarding Social Security and Medicare Act, introduced by an Iowa Republican. It would require the U.S. Comptroller General, whoever the heck that is, to develop a plan to protect benefits from inflation. In other words, give you a bigger cost of living. Well, a great idea. It's not going to solve the problem.
Well, it's going to make the problem worse. Yes. I mean, half of these are making the problem, more than half are making the problem worse.
Almost every one of them.
So what are we doing about the funding side? That's my question.
Exactly. And as soon as anybody brings it up, they just poo-poo it away.
Yeah.
And Washington wants to solve this the old-fashioned Washington way. Three little words. Tax the rich.
But I also think they're addressing it in the very Washington way of waiting until it becomes an absolute imminent problem so that they can then point their fingers at the other side of the aisle and blame them.
You are exactly right. Don't look for a resolution that will be acceptable to any of us at this point. These people are fundamentally unserious about solving the problems.
Absolutely. It's so true.
That's it. As much as I like to report pleasant information, I can't. Let's see what else. The court ruling about immunity for the president. Adam's laughing already.
I know the media and elected officials are prone to hyperbole, but some of the hyperbole about this particular issue has been so unhinged. It's absolutely it's just crazy.
Yes. What this ruling did not do, it did not make Donald Trump 007 but with a license to kill.
He can kill anyone.
No. Marshall's on the phone, and we're just 1 minute from having to break. I hope you can hold on through the break, and we'll pick you up right afterwards. But I got to get done laughing first. What can you say? This is why nothing gets done up there. The hyperbole, as somebody likes to say so much, is far beyond logic or anything else. By the way, in Oregon now, a physician can lose his or her license to practice if he makes some microaggressions to a patient. Had enough? I have. All right, we're going to take a quick break, come back, pick up Marshall right away on the other side. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And on the line is Marshall. Good morning, Marshall.
How you guys doing?
Great. How about you?
You're talking about how screwed up the people in Washington are.
Yep, long topic.
And I want to give some credit to our folks in Tallahassee.
Okay, do.
July 1st, there was a whole series of adjustments.
Yep, the fiscal year.
Mm-hmm. Were calculated.
Yep.
And one in particular hit the reverse mortgage industry, where we had been charged triple what traditional lenders were charged for borrowing, meaning the note stamps and intangible tax. So that is down 2/3 from what it was before.
Wow.
My client that was $3,600 for those taxes is now $1,200, which is more like what the traditional mortgage folks were paying.
That's
nice. So I go to this piece to see the actual legislation, and I see the staff report that gives you the background, the context, all the information. 46 pages, and it appeared to me that all of them were doing the same thing, looking at the basis on which the taxes were being charged and making it a more appropriate number, not changing the rate of the tax, but looking at where the basis had been screwed up. And this has been for many years. So there are some people who are doing it right.
Sounds like an accounting situation to me. Good, bad, or indifferent?
No, it's just that people who don't understand something and make a regulation usually go for the high.
Yeah.
Get the most they possibly can.
Especially if that's how their salaries are paid.
There, yeah. there was a precedent back when we had the graduated payment mortgages that finally somebody in Tallahassee woke up and said, ooh, we screwed up all those years ago.
Wowie, good.
Okay, so somebody acknowledged it.
Huh.
Let me take a wild guess at your trivia question.
Yeah, go for it.
Shoot.
9%.
A little too high.
Yep.
Well, I got you at least a little bit of an edge. Somebody has some great thought in between.
I got a quick question for you.
Yeah.
Do you know what Edwards' Law is in government projects?
Edwards' Law?
Yeah.
No.
Costs are usually at least double what officials first propose.
Ah, okay.
There's nobody but nobody who doesn't believe that exists, right?
Yeah, true.
This sounds like one of those. Well, I'm glad because, you know, we have become, Adam and I have both become over the years big fans of the whole concept of the reverse mortgage for the right people. And whatever we can do to present it to the public with less cost is just a slam dunk. Love it.
I appreciate it.
We appreciate
y'all take
you.
Care.
Thanks, okay. Marshall.
See ya.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Don't often see something like that just kind of come out of the blue, do you?
That's a big savings. And you always are recognizing the fees on a reverse mortgage, and they're not low. No. I mean they're more or less equivalent to what you pay getting a mortgage, but it's something that factors into your thinking about getting one. And so for it to come down to $2,400 or so, it sounded like that's significant.
That's really good. Yeah, the whole concept of the reverse mortgage still suffers from the mistakes they made in the beginning.
Yeah.
They didn't have their act together. The product wasn't that good, and the salesmanship was 10 times worse than the product.
Yeah.
So people are stuck with this misunderstanding, misconceptions, and it's very difficult, as everybody knows, to break that when it's become part of, I wouldn't say common knowledge, but common thought, I guess. But for the right people, if you just want to stop making your payments, or if you want to buy another place and not use all your available cash to do it, there's so many ways that these things can and do work. And all those problems, and now one more in the reverse mortgage industry, are being solved. And every day they're becoming a better and better concept for the right people. But, man, they are hard to get over when somebody's got one of those attitudes left over from them. Well, they're just going to steal my house.
They're going to steal my house. That's what we always hear.
Yep. The bank just wants my house. Well, I will tell you something. Take it for what it's worth because it's correct. Banks don't want your house.
They do not.
If they did, they'd be in the real estate business.
And
they're not.
And it's so funny because a reverse mortgage is just a mortgage.
Yeah.
It's just a type of mortgage. And no one fears getting a mortgage.
No.
So many people fear getting a reverse mortgage.
Yep. And it's they're not going to take it away from you. And you can live out your life in your house. And all you got to do is what you would have to do if you were mortgage free. Maintain it, pay the taxes, pay the insurance.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. If you don't do those things anyway, then you're kind of hopeless.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm glad that Marshall called in. It gives me an even better feeling about it. And when we get into discussions with people in the office, that's just one more little arrow in the quiver, I guess, for the discussion to be held. So, all right, you want to jump in with anything?
Yeah. I saw a great survey this week, and it was done by Bankrate, I believe. It was the Financial Freedom Survey.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out the average American feels like they need to earn over $186,000 a year just to live comfortably.
Yeah, I saw that.
And about 2 in 5, 37% say it's likely that they will ever earn that income. 31% say it's unlikely, and 18% say never, no way, no how.
Hmm. And I have to say, they're probably right.
I mean, that number doesn't sound crazy to me. I mean, it depends on your definition of comfortable, and also it really depends on where you live. In New York City, on 186,000, you're probably not super comfortable. No. In Jacksonville, I would guess that you are.
Depends on the station in life and your family size and a million other things, but it does not sound unreasonable at all to me.
No.
And when you look at what the average salary is now, 59,000, I think, nationwide.
Is it? I don't know.
That's the last number I remember reading. You know, you put those things together and you got the Cumberland Gap in between. I don't see how it's going
to
change.
Actually, according to this, the average full-time year-round worker typically makes $79,000.
Oh, okay. It's up better than I thought.
There's different ways of breaking data down.
But still light $100,000.
Yeah.
From people's perceptions anyway. Right. And that's not going there anytime soon.
No.
It's a shame. All right. I don't know how bad it is out there and what we've done to people and our attitudes and so on. Most millionaires support higher taxes on extreme wealth. Extreme wealth is defined as whatever you make plus a little more.
Wait, are we talking wealth or income?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Both is the answer to that. Millionaires don't mind at all if the tax rate goes higher, as long as it's on income substantially above their own. But the part that's really disturbing to me is that over 50% of millionaires support a wealth tax on billionaires. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the concept, a wealth tax means a tax on everything you own that you've already paid for, et cetera. And in order to pay that, you have no money. So say they're going to tax the gain in your house. You got to, what, mortgage your house? Tax the gain on your business. You got to sell off some of the business. A wealth tax is the most insidious thing that could happen to this country. And the Supreme Court had an excellent chance in June to decide a case where this would go away forever, and they blew it. This Supreme Court is very, I'm going to use a nice word here, cautious. They decide the least amount of the question that they can decide and still issue some kind of a result. So this was a couple who had made money overseas in an investment in a company. Excuse me. And the government wanted a tax on it, even though this company did not distribute the funds to them. It was taxed as a partnership type where they got credited with the profits. Excuse me. And anyway, they decided it on this case, and what they should have decided and what we hoped they would decide was in a blanket way, but didn't happen. Wait, take it for a second. I've got something in my throat.
Okay. Well, as far as the Supreme Court goes, wow, you're really struggling.
Better now.
They've handed down some pretty monumental decisions in the last couple of weeks. So you can say they're conservative about picking and choosing, right. But I mean, honestly, it's been, I think they've been quite aggressive in their rulings and given us some pretty good news recently.
Yeah, that's generally true. I just wish some of these things would put some of these loony ideas to bed, but they haven't done it so far. All right, the S&P is up 16.7% overall year to date, and without the Big Seven, it's still up, which frankly I guessed wrong when Adam brought it up to me. It's up 4%.
Yeah.
So if you're invested in the index shares, they're doing fine.
I mean, if you think about it, the equal weight index is up about 5%. So that makes sense.
Yeah. So overall, it does kind of hang together.
Mm-hmm.
What's left for this year, I couldn't begin to tell you. In fact, some S&P estimates are now not being made by the people. This one was Piper. We're not going to do that anymore because they keep guessing and they're always wrong. So why guess? I like my approach much better. I will tell you exactly what the S&P is going to wind up this year, and I'll tell you sometime in January. Till then, see you next week, same time. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour.